From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Pope recently reaffirmed the Church's ban against the ordination of women as priests. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Father Gustin Noya, theologian to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. Also, this summer is the 30th anniversary of Freedom Summer in Mississippi. Hundreds of college students came to Mississippi to help register black voters. We hear from Bob Moses, who led Freedom Summer. And world music critic Milo Miles reviews two new releases by guitarist Ry Cooder. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. North and South Korea have signed an agreement setting up a first summit meeting. It's the first meeting between the presidents of Korea. The first session is planned for July 25th in Pyongyang, North Korea. The BBC's Simon Long reports.
There's a sense of astonishment in South Korea that after so long without top-level contact, it's proved possible to arrange a summit with North Korea so quickly. North Korean President Kim Il-sung suggested the meeting during discussions with former American President Jimmy Carter in Pyongyang earlier this month. South Korea's Kim Yong-sam accepted at once and suggested the preparatory meeting, which took 8 hours to reach full agreement. It was quickly agreed that Kim Yong-sam would travel to Pyongyang for the first meeting on July the 25th. He's initially to stay for 2 nights, but the agreement says his stay might be extended. But at one point, the preparatory talks seemed on the point of foundering over the South's insistence on a North Korean commitment to a second summit in Seoul. The agreement, signed at the end of the day, concedes North Korea's wish that this issue can be discussed when the presidents meet in Pyongyang.
Simon Long reporting. The White House says President and Mrs. Clinton have established a legal defense fund to offset the costs of defending themselves. Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers says contributions to the fund will be limited to $1,000 each. Myers says those who set up the fund did it carefully to avoid any conflicts. Some ethics experts are warning that this kind of fund could create the perception that donors are buying influence with the White House. The Clintons are defending themselves in the federal Whitewater land deal case and a sexual harassment suit against the president. The chiefs of the FBI and the Drug Enforcement Administration have arrived in Germany on a tour to improve cooperation between their agencies and similar Eastern European agencies. The officials are especially interested in fighting internationally organized crime. Lynn Weil reports.
With European integration and the end of the Cold War, barriers between many countries have slackened or dropped, giving gangs in both the East and West easier access to potential new terrain. Police across Europe report that the exchange of weapons, drugs, and other illegal imports has risen, along with extortion and murder attributed to organized crime. To reverse this trend, FBI Director Louis Freeh and DEA head Thomas Constantine are trying to promote cooperation with law enforcement agencies in 11 countries. They advocate training foreign law enforcement officers in the United States and opening access to local police databases. Discussion has only begun as to how this new initiative is to be funded. Congress is in the midst of determining the FBI's budget for the next year. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Weil in Berlin.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 16.5 points to 3,668. This is NPR. The U.S. soccer team has advanced to the second round of the World Cup soccer tournament. It's the first time the U.S. team has done this in 64 years. The squad didn't even have to play to advance. Tie games between Ireland and Norway and Italy and Mexico left the United States with 4 points in the first round group. That's enough to qualify. The U.S. will meet Brazil or Sweden in its next game to be played in Stanford, California. General Motors Corporation has named Richard Wagoner as president of its North American operations. The announcement is part of a major reorganization of the company's top management. Paul Eisenstein reports from Detroit.
Today's management changes have been the subject of months of rumors. General Motors has come a long way from 1991, when its North American automotive operations were losing about $750 million a month, but it's still barely breaking even on every car and truck it sells here in the U.S. And the corporate shuffle is designed to make it even easier to implement an ongoing cost reduction program. Under the realignment, Richard Wagner becomes the new president of GM's North American unit. A former college basketball star, Wagner is seen as both a team player and a charismatic leader who can motivate the troops. Just how much more does GM have to do? According to a recent study, GM's assembly plants were among the least efficient in North America, and it recommends GM eliminate another 20,000 factory jobs. For National Public Radio, I'm Paul Eisenstein in Detroit.
The big three American automakers are teaming up to create more fuel-efficient and cleaner-running cars. Chrysler, Ford, and General Motors made the announcement today. The goal of the Natural Gas Vehicle Technologies Partnership is to cut the cost of building naturally gas-powered vehicles. And a Ford official says cars that run on natural gas can cost up to $6,000 more to make than conventional cars. The extra cost comes mostly from storage tanks used in natural gas-powered vehicles. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, Pope John Paul II wrote a letter to bishops upholding the ban against the ordination of women as priests. He wrote, "In order that all doubt may be removed regarding a matter of great importance, I declare that the Church has no authority whatsoever to confer priestly ordination on women, and that this judgment is to be definitively held by all the Church's faithful." My guest, Father Gus DeNoia, is the theologian to the National Conference of Bishops. We asked him to explain to us why women cannot be ordained in the Roman Catholic Church. First, I asked him to summarize the Pope's letter.
The letter is rather brief, actually, and its content can be stated quite simply. It harkens back to earlier communications and simply rehearses what's contained in earlier letters about the matter, essentially since 1976. The issue is that because Christ did not choose women to be among his apostles, although he had very many close associates who were women, because he did not do so, the Church has not done so and believes itself unable to do so. Now, there is no, if I may say, what the letter does not state, which is extraordinarily interesting, actually. It does not appeal to any qualities, either of maleness or femaleness, substantiate this. So it's not saying that women are, for some reason, do not have the proper characteristics. Men do. It doesn't claim that because Christ was a man, priests must be men. These arguments are, no reference is made to any arguments which attach ordination and its recipients to specifically male qualities, which I think is extraordinarily important for the question of gender and the Church.
One of the reasons the Pope has given, I guess the primary reason for not ordaining women, is that Jesus chose men as his apostles. As a theologian, is it your job to ask, why did Jesus choose only men as his apostles? Or is that something you'd prefer not to speculate about?
No, that's a good question. It is a good question, one that I would ask. May I use an analogy here?
Please.
The Eucharist, right? I mean, the Mass, Holy Communion. Communion is celebrated with bread and wine. Now, some people have sometimes suggested that it be celebrated with other things, other elements, so-called. And the Church has always said, well, we can't celebrate it with other elements because Christ celebrated it with bread and wine. Now, because we had no Eucharist except because Christ gave it to us, then we can't do with the Eucharist what he didn't do, even though there might be terrifically good reasons, perhaps the unavailability of wine in certain cultures. There would be good reasons for doing differently. Now, subsequently, theologians do think a lot about why bread and wine were apt choices, but again, you see, the analogy is similar to the situation with the ordination of women. There would be no such thing as a priesthood, the Church is saying, if Christ did not institute it. So we have only the parameters established by his action and behavior in the matter, you see, similar to the bread and wine in the Eucharist. So the Church is just saying, no matter what anybody says about this matter, and they could make terrifically intelligible cases, you know, for alternatives in these areas, the Church is saying it doesn't feel authorized to act in a way in an area which would not exist, you might say, in a matter where there would be nothing to talk about without Christ's example. It doesn't feel free to act in a way differently. Although, then it does ask the question, why did he do it this way? Excuse me. A theologian would.
Okay? So, and what answer would you come up with?
Yikes, Terry. I don't, I mean, I'm not sure. No, I mean that, I have thought about this a lot.
There's a morally complex answer.
No, I've thought about it a lot. I mean, but I think it would be, if I may put it this way, at this moment, it's a little confusing for me to give you what my reasons for it might be, because we're concentrating here on trying to be clear that the letter itself is extraordinarily sparing in its giving of reasons. You see, so and especially reasons rooted in gender differences, which has got to be where the explanation would presumably have to emerge.
Is this like walking through a minefield for you, dealing with something that has to do with gender but doesn't really address what's inherently different about gender?
Not a minefield, not really. I mean, I think that we've learned because of feminist thought, everybody has thought about these matters much more intensely in the last 20 to 30 years than has ever been done in the whole history of inquiry, even philosophical inquiry. So, and there's a lot of dispute about what the status of gender differences are, what biologically, psychologically, metaphysically. So I tend at this moment to think that the state of the discussion, to be honest with you, is premature for the church to, for a theologian to adopt any really strong case for the action of Christ in this matter. I think is going to be a little bit premature. I mean, the church has affirmed and constantly over the last 20 to 30 years, the importance of women, the significance of women and their role in the church and their authority. My boss, if I may put it that way, at the National Conference of Catholic Bishops is a woman, Sister Sharon Ewart. And this is true across the United States and across the church, that women do in fact occupy positions of extraordinary importance and authority, because the church feels itself free to put them into those positions, even though it does not feel itself free to put them into the position of ordination. You see what I mean? In other words, every conceivable area at this moment in which women could exercise authority and leadership in the church has been open to them. This is the only one that has not been.
We know what a lot of women are thinking. If it's considered discrimination in our society to exclude women from any anything, job or any part of society, why is it morally okay to exclude women from such an important function within the church?
Well, because, you see, this function is in its structure stipulated by an institutional act on the part of Christ, so that the church cannot do here what he didn't do. Now, you know, see, this is another important thing to recognize, is that there are many men who aren't priests. So that the role of priesthood, I mean, that I am a priest, say, from the point of view of the church, does not make me, give me a greater status in any really significant, spiritually significant way from any other man or woman. So that the argument that ordination must be open to everyone is misleading, because it suggests that ordination constitutes a higher rank, that priesthood constitutes a higher rank in the church in some deeply significant way. Now, of course, it does involve a spiritual authority, but I am equal, to put it this way, the Pope, me, and any other member of the church are all equal in the sight of God in the matters, in things that really matter, which are spiritual and personal, matters of personal and spiritual identity, even though the Pope has exercised extraordinary authority in the church. He is, you might say, we are all equal in the sight of God. So it's a religious argument, and I know that in modern societies especially in the last 100 or 200 years or so. I mean, the whole rights and freedom, movements of rights and freedoms that we have from modernity make it very difficult to make that case. And I'm quite aware that I'm making a case which will strike some people as being a little bit dotty. but you're asking me for a theological response, and that's the only one I can give, that ordination does not make you rank higher in matters of real importance in the church from others.
What would you say the church has learned watching other religions in which women are ordained, and in branches of Judaism, women are ordained. In the Episcopal Church, women have been allowed to be ordained for, mm-hmm. I don't know, about 15 years. Many Protestant churches, women
right.
are ordained now. What do you see when you look there, and is there anything that's relevant to the Catholic
right.
Church?
That's also a very good question. But begin, however, by mentioning the Orthodox churches. That's the churches of the Greek, Russian, and all of the branches of the Orthodox Church. A friend of mine who's visiting me just over the weekend said to me that it would be unthinkable in the Orthodox Church to ordain women. So that in this, in announcing this constant teaching in this letter, the Church has... The Catholic Church has a definite eye toward the Orthodox churches with whom it is struggling mightily to have better relations. Now, these, you know, if I may bring in the wider world at the moment, you have to realize that at this moment, with the collapse of the Soviet bloc, the Orthodox churches are all sort of reorganizing, and there are tremendously important discussions going on in the Ukraine, in Russia generally, and in all of the former republics of the Soviet Union, and then in other Eastern Bloc nations where the Orthodox churches are very, very strong. There is a tremendous amount of discussion going on between the Catholic Church, the Holy See, and those churches, within which the idea of ordination of women is simply, as my friend said, unthinkable. So, you see, I mean, in the Catholic Church, holy orders is a sacrament. It's one of the seven sacraments. Well, in the other churches, except for Anglicanism, it is not a sacrament, and it does not confer any particular sacramental character or mark on the person who receives it. It's just a functional matter. It's a matter of service in the church and not conceived of as a sacramental transformation of the person who receives it, somewhat like baptism or the Eucharist. Now, with Anglicanism, the situation is different because Anglicanism professed to be much closer to the Catholic Church on this issue. But you know as well as I do that the move of the Anglicans to ordain women has not been a one that was made without tremendous conflict and disruption within the Anglican Church. The Catholic Church would be simply saying that whatever these other churches do in this area, or feel themselves able to do in this area, it stands with the Orthodox as affirming a constant tradition of not ordaining women.
You know what some people are saying about the apostles' connection here. Jesus also chose Jews to be his apostles. Does that mean all priests need to be Jews?
Right.
I don't. You know, that's maybe said half in jest, but answer that. I mean, how do you answer that?
Well, almost immediately. The church moved beyond Palestinian Judaism, and encompassed wide numbers of varieties of people. But although it is true that Christ only chose Jews to be among his apostles, it was clear that the intention. You see, that's a good judgment call. It was clear that his intention was to embrace the entire. To embrace all of the nations as members of this community, and that happened almost within, within months, you might say, of his death, that there began to be people from other ethnic groups. Indeed, Palestine itself was already quite cosmopolitan. There were many Greek cities, and certainly there was no intention. I mean, I'd say the church recognized that there it would be inconceivable for Christ to have intended by his having only Jewish disciples that only Jews should be disciples. You know, so that would be that's a case of a judgment call.
My guest is Father Gus Denoia, theologian to the National Conference of Bishops. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing the Pope's recent letter to bishops saying the Church cannot ordain women as priests. My guest, Father Gus Denoia, is theologian to the National Conference of Bishops. I'm wondering where you come in a situation like this where the Pope issues a letter on why ordination should be reserved for men alone. Did you know about the letter before it's issued?
No. Excuse me.
When do you find out about it? And then what does your job become after the letter's released?
You mean my job at the Bishops' Conference?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, essentially, I did have a little lead time.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't have said no so quickly. I did have a little lead time, but not very much, actually. It was a very difficult thing because I found out about it. It was the middle of the Memorial Day weekend, so it was quite chaotic trying to get anything out to the press, you know, helping the press to understand it. Now, my own job becomes trying to help. Specifically, my job is to help the bishops. So what I did was I made up 15 of the hardest questions I could think of about this, some of which you have already asked, and answered them in 3 pages or so, which we then faxed to all of them. Now, when I say made up hard questions, I meant questions which people would obviously ask. And then I tried to give as intelligent case for the action as I could, because I mean, one thing that is important to understand is that Catholics believe that that the Pope and the bishops too, when they teach authoritatively, and that the Holy Spirit is present to them, so that there has to, you know, from a Catholic point of view, there has to be an interior acceptance in faith of things of importance. So it's part of our whole attitude towards the teaching authority that we would accept. So I'm not, in other words, it's not me putting a spin on this teaching, but I myself sincerely accept it and then try to give an intelligent, just as I'm doing with you, try to give as intelligent a case for it as I can.
Would you allow a part of yourself to wish that the Pope had done differently, or is it really not your place to wish those kinds of things, no matter what you feel?
You know, there is a part of me that certainly recognizes the spiritual gifts of many women that I have encountered who have had powerful influences over my life. In fact, one could say, you know, if I were going to be autobiographical, that there are probably more women who have had influence over my faith that has been significant than any men. And that goes back to the second grade teacher to whom I, in a sense, feel I owe my vocation, and to a fifth grade teacher who first told me about the Dominican Order, which I belong to now. So that you have a feeling, I suppose, that given this great spiritual authority that so many women have, you'd say to yourself, well, why couldn't they be ordained too? And in that sense, so that I do permit myself to ask the question, but I nonetheless, as a Catholic, not a Catholic loyal to the Pope, by the way, because our allegiance is not to the Pope, but as a Catholic who believes that God has so ordered the Church as to have embodied in the teaching of the Pope and the bishops his intentions for the Church, I accept this teaching, even though it strikes me as a difficult one. I mean, I recognize it as a difficult one for many people to accept. Does that make sense to you? In other words, I feel loyalty to the Pope as Pope, but what constitutes my reasons for accepting these teachings is not loyalty or allegiance to the Pope, but a conviction that in the Church, As ordered by Christ, the Pope speaks in his name.
Now, has the Pope's letter effectively ended debate on the issue of ordination of women? And say one of the bishops who you consult with disagrees with the Pope. Are they allowed to express it? What happens?
Well, if a person disagrees with a teaching, okay, suppose I'm a bishop, and I think on this matter that the Pope has made a mistake, let's say. Suppose I thought that.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, what would be required of me would be two things. First of all, the struggle to confront as honestly as I can the Pope's teaching as a challenge to my convictions. Suppose I am convinced women should be ordained. Then when the Pope teaches this, then I should be internally, my determination should be one of trying to struggle with my own views to see if I can assent internally. And then it may turn out that I still am, I have doubts. You see, I mean, I may have doubts nonetheless, but then what is required of me as a bishop would be never to express those doubts in a way that would unsettle the people over whom I have authority in the church. So that's why the bishop would keep any doubts, or a theologian would keep any doubts he had about the matter to himself, because of the role of authority that he has, or the theologian he or she has in the church.
Just another behind-the-scenes question. When you send your interpretations to the bishops, do they have to agree with your interpretation or follow it?
Oh, God, no.
No?
No, see, one thing that's important to understand about the Catholic Church is that it's not, and the Conference of Catholic Bishops, is that the bishops are members of the conference, but their authority is not subject to the conference. I mean, each bishop is answerable only to the Holy See, to the Pope. I mean, so that's, it's truly a college. So every bishop, even the cardinals, whom we tend to assume have a tremendous amount of influence, no cardinal is any more, every cardinal is equal with every bishop. So all the bishops are equally members of the College of Bishops with the Pope. So now, and each bishop has his own, often his own theologians, and many of them on the big dioceses especially, like, say, Chicago or New York, they're not waiting with bated breath, let me tell you, with what comes from DeNoia sitting in Washington. They will get whatever help they can from it, but, oh no, they're entirely free to talk about the matter without even referring to anything that I say about it. In fact, the bishops just had an assembly in San Diego, and one of them didn't even know about my 15 questions. He hadn't even seen them, of all the things that came across his desk. So, no, they are not bound by any means. We're just helping them. In a way, we're like a staff which supplies them, tries to help them in ways that will be useful, but they make whatever use of what we send them that they want to.
Father Gus DeNoia is theologian to the National Conference of Bishops. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This is the 30th anniversary of Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of college students came to Mississippi to help register black voters. Coming up, we hear from Bob Moses, who led Freedom Summer. And world music critic Milo Miles tells us about Rai Cooter's latest releases, collaborations with Indian musician V.M. Bhatt and African guitarist Ali Farkatoure. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The prosecution and the defense are preparing for Thursday's preliminary hearing in the O.J. Simpson case. Prosecutor Marcia Clark predicts it will take a week to present her side of the case. Defense lawyer Robert Shapiro hasn't estimated how long his case might take. Simpson is accused of murdering his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman. International peace mediators in Paris are completing a new Bosnian peace plan, but the fighting in the former Yugoslav Republic is still going on. Richard Carruthers reports.
The UN says the Muslim-led Bosnian government army is consolidating positions it captured in a week-long offensive against Serb forces in central Bosnia. A spokesman said the Bosnian army is gaining ground around a road that would link its troops in the north and center of the republic. They could then prepare for a possible offensive on the strategically important Serbian supply corridor. In Paris, officials from the US, Russia, Europe, and the UN are considering maps which would give the Muslim Croat Federation 51% of territory and the Bosnian Serbs the rest. But their efforts to prevent another winter of war seem increasingly irrelevant as the government decides to fight for what it's lost. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
French troops in Rwanda have evacuated 35 nuns who were trapped since the country's massacres started 2 months ago. The group is now in Zaire. The BBC's Ben Brown reports from the Rwandan-Zairean border.
Five French army helicopters airlifted the nuns out of Rwanda this morning. For them, the last 2 months have been an almost unimaginable ordeal. On frequent occasions, they were taken out of their hillside convent by Hutu militiamen, separated into their different nationalities, and told they were about to be shot. In the end, none was executed, but many of those brought out to safety today are deeply traumatized. Their mother superior says they were consistently threatened, often at night. All around them in the town, Tutsis were being massacred in their thousands. Some reports say that virtually the entire Tutsi population there, some 10,000 people, have been slaughtered. The nuns are from different countries. Many of them are ethnic Tutsis, and obviously they were in particular danger.
Ben Brown reporting. Congress continues work on health care reform bills. The Senate Finance Committee is hammering out various proposals. Two Democrats on the committee are predicting the panel will reject plans that cover all Americans and instead choose a less broad approach. The House Ways and Means Committee worked late into the night on its plan. It's similar to President Clinton's legislation, which guarantees coverage for all Americans. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 16 points to end the day at 3,669. Declines beat advances by a margin of 2-1 in heavy trading of 265 million shares. This is NPR. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would end restrictions on regional Bell telephone companies. They would be able to offer certain long-distance services and build equipment. The legislation is supposed to replace the consent decree that broke up the Ma Bell system 10 years ago. It lays out the ground rules for the regional phone companies' entry into the lucrative long-distance industry. The bill would let regional phone companies provide cable TV service, wireless communications, and other services outside their legal boundaries. A heat wave has been baking the southwestern part of the country, but weather forecasters say it may let up somewhat today. Andy Gobiel of member station KENW reports from Portales, New Mexico.
Meteorologists say after reaching highs of nearly 120 degrees across the region, a slight cooling trend may be in the forecast. Dan Hogan is with the National Weather Service in Midland, Texas.
There's a little bit of cooling lost in the upper levels of the atmosphere, so it's going to be maybe about 5 degrees cooler than yesterday. So it might cool down to about 110.
Midland hit an all-time high of 116 degrees yesterday. 10 cities in New Mexico hit at least 100 degrees. The high temperatures and dry conditions there have increased the danger of flare-ups and forest fires that have already laid bare more than 90,000 acres of land. Arizona saw a high of 126 degrees, and Palm Springs, California reached 114 degrees. Meteorologists say these temperatures may portend a very hot summer. For National Public Radio, I'm Andy Gobiel in Portales, New Mexico.
The National Weather Service has added a new sun hazard rating to its daily weather report. The forecast began immediately. The service says with the ultraviolet index forecast, the public will be better able to protect itself from overexposure. Ultraviolet radiation has been cited as the cause of skin cancer, the nation's most common form of cancer. The National Weather Service will issue ultraviolet ratings on a 1 to 10 scale, some areas 1 to 15 scale. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the 30th anniversary of an important event in the civil rights movement, Freedom Summer. In the summer of 64, hundreds of college students from the North went south to Mississippi to help register black voters. Three of the young activists, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, were murdered by white racists. Bob Moses led the Mississippi Voter Registration Project. What Moses is doing today doesn't have the drama of Freedom Summer, but he's convinced it will open up equally important opportunities. Moses is the head of the Algebra Project. His mission is to make young African Americans literate in math. Moses was a math teacher in New York before he joined the Civil Rights Movement. For most of the 70s, he lived in Tanzania, where he taught math. He grew up in Harlem and received his master's in philosophy from Harvard before going down to Mississippi in 1960. When I spoke with Bob Moses last year, I asked him if there was an incident that turned him into an activist.
Well, it was the sit-ins. I was teaching at Horace Mann School in New York City. It was a private school right outside in Riverdale, outside of New York, and I was teaching math at the middle school level. And when the 60s, when the sit-ins broke in February, and I began reading and looking at the pictures in the New York Times, I felt like I had to go down and take a look firsthand at what was going on, because the people in the pictures, the students, the young black students, really look like I felt. I mean, I could feel in their looks what was going on inside me.
Could you describe what that feeling was?
Well, there's sort of a lot of repressed anger and resentment and a seething feeling that had been building up in me through high school and college and graduate school and watching the events of the 50s unfold. And what the students, I felt, were doing was they were getting directly at that.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so it was very powerful.
You know, I think there were two things. One, you were from the North going to the, from the urban North going to the rural South. Also, you were, you know, a Harvard grad. You were very educated, and you were going to a rural part of the country in which most of the people you were dealing with didn't have that kind of formal education. Did you feel like an outsider, and were you treated initially like an outsider who didn't quite get it?
I guess I didn't feel that way, and that certainly may have helped a lot for not being treated that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason I didn't feel that way is that my father and my family, we grew up in the Harlem River houses in New York City, which was a low-rent income project, but it turned out to be a little village. You know that saying, it takes a village to raise a child, that's that African proverb?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had a little village there at the Harlem River houses when I was growing up. This was in the 40s and the early 50s. And we had a community of adults and young children who worked together to provide really a nurturing environment for the youngsters growing up there. And so I grew up really with a very close base to working class, average you know, workers and people in Harlem. So I, although I knew about, you know, this other sort of higher type of society business, I was never really feeling like I was a part of that. And what happened was that I had very good mentors. I had Amzie Moore in Cleveland, Mississippi, who had lived there most of his life and who was the head of the NAACP there, and who was just a good organizer and also leader, and he played both roles.
How did you develop the focus for Mississippi Summer?
Well, the focus for Mississippi first really was developed through AMSI. AMSI looked at the students and the energy which they were carrying in the sit-in movement and said, they can really do something here in Mississippi if we take that energy and refocus it instead of on public accommodations, on voting and political rights. And so he mapped out the concept of a voter registration program for students to run, and I went down and really sort of brought it into reality with him and the other NAACP leaders who were left, Steptoe down in Amick County and C.C. Bryant down there in Macomb.
Did it make sense to you to focus on voter registration instead of integrating public facilities?
Yes, right. In fact, it was one of the things which was seething in me all during the 50s. Because you remember, after World War II, there was all this talk about the right to vote in Eastern Europe. And, you know, I just over and over again, and we were having the filibusters in the Senate and so forth, and I kept asking myself, you know, Eastern Europe, sure, but what about people in this country? What about black folks?
What would you use, what would you do to convince people that it was worth the risk to try to register?
Well, I think people's backs were up against the wall, so there was a consensus that we all ought to try to register. And then, not that we all, well, that it should be done. And then the question was, well, who are the people who are ready to step out? Now, one of the things was our accompanying them to the registration office. So in those areas where people felt more at home going down there, if we accompanied them, we did. And that's the registration office became the scene of little battles. In Walthall County, the sheriff pistol-whipped John Hardy when he brought some people in. And then in Amick County, they had some guys who came and jumped on me when I accompanied some people down to register in Liberty.
When you accompanied people to register to vote, on the occasions when they didn't beat you up and you got into the registrar's office, what were the typical obstacles that you'd face?
Well, the delaying tactics, so they would take one person at a time, and, you know, they would just drag it out. And then the people had to fill out some section of the Constitution and interpret it, so they would give them some very difficult passage to read and to write about. And then there would be some intimidations. Usually you would have law enforcement officers and highway patrolmen, you know, sort of walking in and out, and then, so it would be a sort of intimidating atmosphere. And a lot of times then you would also have ordinary citizens coming in, and sometimes they would talk to people, you know, to try to intimidate them.
What would you do to make it clear that you couldn't be intimidated? And especially when people are trying to intimidate others.
Well, mostly
others
we just kept coming back.
Right, right.
I guess that was the bottom line. That is that, okay, whatever you do, you know, you knock us down and we get back up and we come back. So that was basically it.
My guest is Bob Moses. He led Mississippi's Freedom Summer in 1964. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Bob Moses is my guest. Were there tremendous acts of courage and cowardice that you witnessed in Mississippi?
Yeah, I think there were a lot of acts of courage. And some of them, you know, were small in one sense. There were a group of ladies when we were in jail in Macomb who took it upon themselves to deliver food to us every day. They cooked it themselves and they delivered it, and about 16 of us there in jail. And of course, in doing that, they were branded, right? And later, one of them had her house bombed. So there were a lot of those kind of things happening. And then, of course, there were, people were murdered. Herbert Lee, Lewis Allen had a tremendous issue. He witnessed a murder, and Herbert Lee, who was one of the farmers working with us, got gunned down at the cotton gin there in Liberty, the same place where I had gotten beaten. And Lewis Allen saw it, and so the issue of testifying before the Justice of Peace, the jury that they pulled together there, and of giving his testimony to the federal government and the Justice Department saying, well, there's no way we can give you any protection. And because of that, he suffered, you know, he got his jaw broken by one of the policemen down there. They put him in and out of jail over a couple of years, and finally they killed him. They drove up onto his front lawn one day and you know, blasted him away. And he sort of lived that really on his own for over a couple of years, because Herbert Lee was killed in 61, and Lewis Allen was shot down in the beginning of 64, and it was really his death which really turned the corner about having the Mississippi Freedom Summer. It's like we had come full circle, and we weren't able to do anything in response to Herbert Lee's murders, but we were in position to do something when Lewis Allen was gunned down.
When people were murdered in Mississippi, people in the civil rights movement from Mississippi, or people from outside who'd come down to work there, like Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, was it a personal crisis for you, too?
Yeah. Herbert Lee was the first person that we were working with very closely who was murdered, and that was in the first summer when we went down. And I guess the only way in which we could sort of live through it was to say, well, we are going to live our lives and go through the same kind of danger that led to his being murdered. And so we're not asking other people to do what we are not also daily doing. And that's how, from my point of view, I got through it.
Has the sense of responsibility that you may have felt when people were killed in Mississippi stayed with you over the years?
Well, there's a sense of responsibility, but there's the sense of, I guess, that you were in a war, really. Mississippi was a war zone, and we may have made some mistakes, but we didn't try to tag mistakes to murders, right? So what I guess we said was that we all were exposed to the same dangers, and on balance, on balance, it was it was a job was like damned if you do and damned if you don't, and we got through it in some way. I mean, what you can say is that Mississippi became a part of the United States. It became a state like other states. It was no longer a law unto itself. It was no longer our apartheid situation. And in getting through it, well, we felt like we did something, you know, that, and blood had to, it was clear that blood was going to be shed. It was being shed before we got there. I don't think anyone was thinking that we would get through it without more blood being shed.
Bob Moses, he led Freedom Summer 30 years ago. He's now the head of the Algebra Project, which teaches math literacy to young African Americans. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have news today about Haitians and why once again many Haitians are trying to leave the island. Also, as the leaders of North and South Korea announced that they will talk, we'll be hearing about just how little contact there is between the two Koreas. Checking back on the Citadel, the military academy in the South, and the woman who has been admitted there, we'll find out what's happened with that. And also, given that yesterday Leon Panetta was named the new White House Chief of Staff, we will examine the history, rather short history, of that office, and also hear about what sorts of people have done the best job.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Guitarist Ry Cooder was explaining world music more than a decade before anyone called it that. And world music commentator Milo Miles says Cooder's mix of curiosity and musical integrity earns the attention and admiration he receives. Though not total breakthroughs, Cooder's collaborations with African guitarist Ali Farka Touré and Indian musician V.M. Bhatt are always engrossing.
A question. When are albums that try to fuse music traditions a success? Well, it depends on what you expect them to do, the impossible or just the unlikely. Musics that are truly separate, like Indian ragas and Western blues, cannot be blended at one stroke. It's impossible. Successful intermingling takes at least a generation of deeply infatuated musicians on both sides. Now, a wonderfully ambitious fusion album can discover connections and get serious crosstalk going between different musics. It's unlikely, but it can be done. If you hope for the unlikely, not the impossible, Ry Cooder's current pair of fusion albums will satisfy. Cooder's joint venture with V.M. Bhatt is called A Meeting by the River, and it's not quite the long shot it sounds like. For one thing, Bhatt plays a highly modified guitar he calls a Mohan Veena, that nevertheless still sounds a lot like a slide guitar. The recording is exceptionally clear and detailed. The session was done very casually, with minimal preparation and not much attention to formal structure. The selection you just heard, Ganges Delta Blues, shows the riffing between Cooder and Bhatt reaching a mild delirium. If anything, however, the affair is too loose. The last track goes nowhere at all, and there are slack sections here, there, and everywhere. Even so, Cooter and Bott do seem fascinated by each other's tone, and the overall atmosphere is pleasantly light. When Cooter plays with Ali Farka Touré, he is on more familiar ground. Ali Farka Touré combines folk forms from Mali with blues. But his meeting with Cooter, called Talking Timbuktu, is not the sure thing, it sounds like. There was considerable planning and practice before these sessions, and if anything, they're a little too tight, with Cooter almost disappearing into what amounts to an Ali Farka Touré record with exquisite special attachments. There are numerous delights. Touré sings robustly throughout. His folkish tributes to the grass snake and the river spirit are serene indeed. And a couple tracks, one called Dayarabi in particular, gather tremendous dignity and force that recall the torment of the blues without explicitly evoking it. Rai Cooter often seems to be hinting at grander work than he achieves, but he is never cheesy or facile. I'm confident that when better fusions are made, Cooter will be part of them.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. A Meeting by the River is on the Water Lily Acoustics label. Talking Timbuktu is from World Circuit Ryko Disc. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Phyllis Myers, with Sue Spolin and Nancy Greenlease, and help today from Mark Tullis. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our interns are Philo Holland, Abby Beshkin, and Marcus Tosig. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, thank you for smoking. We talk with Christopher Buckley about his new novel, which satirizes the tobacco industry and the public relations experts who defend it. Christopher Buckley is the son of William F. and a former speechwriter for George Bush. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.